Myself personally, I was scammed recently. Recently, about a year and a half ago, I think there was an NFT Porsche drop. I followed the real thing at night. I woke up in the morning, half asleep, made an Ethereum transfer with one eye open. I didn't even know what the hell was going on for $100, and I sent it to the wrong. I sent it to the wrong address because it came from some stupid phishing email. Right? It took me about 3 weeks to say, oh, okay, I'm a cybersecurity guy, and I just got scammed, you know?
Taka Talks, exposing financial systems, one story at a time.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Taka Talks. Today, we have with us Jean-Michel Azopardi. So Jean-Michel is an accomplished tech and business professional with a strong background in blockchain and startups. With over a decade of experience, he excels in driving partnerships, sales, and innovation. Jean-Michel has secured significant funding, pioneered groundbreaking blockchain technology, and built up top-performing remote teams. Now, as a public speaker and content creator, he showcases his passion for the evolving Web3 ecosystem. Jean-Michel's leadership as the head of the APAC channel, which you need to tell us about, resulted in substantial revenue growth. At the same time, his role as a blockchain architect for Web3 VC fund demonstrates his strategic expertise. So that is the official biography. Now tell us about yourself, the unofficial.
It seems so. So unofficially, I'm a lot less interesting. I'm kind of crude, impatient, and love blockchain and sometimes coffee or at least that sort of first one in the morning. But as far as blockchain goes, it was a sort of love at first sight moment. And before I dive in, thank you so much, Sharon, for the kind intro and Murad as well. I saw recently that, TakaDAO secured funding from Draper and Associates, I believe. So congratulations is in order. That's a hell of an achievement. Back to the sort of my weird story. And I guess I think it's interesting to preface this by way of failure in the schooling system, right, Murad? I think that's the better which rings true. So from a very young age, I realized I was fortunate enough, basically, to go to private school when I was younger, and I realized that my teachers know a lot of information about very specific subjects, but not much else about anything else. I also realized from a very young age that my dad works half the hours and takes a siesta every single day. And doesn't know nearly as much about specific topics as they do. So why am I trying to absorb information from people that are telling me that this is the thing I will need in life when they are in their mid-40s, probably already in a broken relationship, and had their finances in a total mess? Something didn't align with me, even when I was a kid.
Where did you go to school, by the way? Just context.
We had a school here. It's a British school in Malta called St. Edward's.
Where are you based?
I'm based out of Malta.
Okay.
Which is the blockchain island, let's say, or once was the blockchain island.
Gotcha. So you were born and raised there?
I am 100% Maltese with a French name. I don't speak any French. I don't speak any Maltese. And this is for a very similar reason, actually, because, again, as a kid, I realized that there's certain, our brains are each wired differently to work in different ways. Like I realize now that I'm a very visual learner, which is one of the reasons why school was never fantastic for me. I don't learn well via text. I learned great via image and audio, right? While I was at school, I also realized I have trouble with languages in general, mostly because as a human being, I don't like following syntax, which is one of the reasons why maybe why the blockchain world is so interesting to me. Because I hate following syntax in most ways, but then in other ways, I think it's fundamentally important. But language is very much syntax-based. And at a young age, I realized, what's the point of learning a language spoken by 400,000 people when I can master a language spoken by 6 billion? So it's just, okay, put all the effort out of national heritage and stick it into making something happen. So I'm my brain, as you can see, works in kind of weird ways. And that's, I think, what led me to the blockchain industry. And I noticed that, and I mentioned this before, that people in this industry, I think this is a stark difference between people in this industry who have joined pre-2017 and post-2017. I think there's a very different mindset. And I think in the pre-2017 individuals are one of two people. They are either heavy cryptographers or have some kind of appreciation for the notions of cryptography and the beauty of it and what it can do. And then there were customers of the Silk Road. Those were the two sort of OGs of this industry, right? Which explains a lot the situation that we're in today, right? It's why there's now so many scams. There's FTX. Finally, SBF has been convicted, etc. But the industry has definitely evolved in an interesting way over these 5 years. I know I'm doing the sort of long way around introduction here, but let's say from a sort of personal point, XIBM started when I had long hair, really bald now. Found Bitcoin 1 year after I found after I started working in the corporate IT world, and I found it out through a video called Julian Assange, one of my personal heroes. That video was leaked via WikiLeaks back then, and in an attempt to censor the video, which was actually, it's a horrible atrocity of the US government is what that video was. Visa and MasterCard pulled all ties with WikiLeaks, so they couldn't take any kind of donations anymore. And then they wake up one day in 2011 and say, hey, we're taking donations in this thing called Bitcoin. And I was like, what the hell is Bitcoin? So that was that's sort of my intro into this industry. So I saw the first use case back then, which was censorship, you know, which is what it was always about, really. But I was too young, I think, too young and immature to stick the pieces of the puzzle together. You know, I was just trying to understand how the hell the monetary system worked back then. You know, that's I think one of the reasons why the industry has taken so long to evolve, because it touches so many facets of life that implementing it requires considerable understanding across multiple areas, cross-functional areas. And it's very difficult for one single person to have that expertise and that oversight, which is why AI is moving much faster than blockchain, because you don't have that limitation with AI. You can have a small team of three, focused on a tiny use case, massive data set, good compute, and then I'll go with you train over and over and over. Blockchain is different. You need to understand law, you need to understand currency, you need to understand tech, you need to understand finance. There's so many different aspects, which is why I think the situation is taking long to evolve. But anyway, that's the short intro. So I'm happy to be on the show as well, finally. And Sharon, I can see you've got a little gaming PC. It looks like a gaming PC in the background, or maybe a really cool workstation.
Yeah. No, we all use very highly, I would say, gaming PCs for the team. And, you know, we work from home, so a few of my kids actually are working with us as well. So they're all PC gamers. We're like, All of them.
Love it. Love it. So yeah. So Thursday evenings are basically LAN days, I'm assuming, or multiplayer game days, basically.
It's happening a lot. Exactly. Yeah. So amazing. You know, so you first stumbled into that. What was the year, actually?
2011.
So did you, you know, like all of us, we got introduced very early. We had some disbelief. Some of my friends actually lost the first iPhone, where some Bitcoin were given away to them.
Of course.
Did you had any of those story to share along that way?
We'll be right back after the break.
Tekka Talks brings you stories from around the world that will help you understand how crypto and Islamic finance can change our lives for the better. Subscribe and follow us to keep learning.
I mean, most people who were in this industry back then have this kind of story, which tells me you're from that sort of era too, because you've learned this lesson as well. So, yes, my story isn't too painful, thankfully, but it is just because I've made peace with it and never really got that far. So, I was never really interested in money, not for a long time. I never cared about money. I don't care about crypto. I care about blockchain. They're two fundamentally different things. Bitcoin being the only real exception to that statement, with maybe Ethereum. But basically, as soon as I found out about this, as soon as I read the white paper, I go up to my dad, and I was working at. I believe IBM at the time, exactly. So first job, right? And back then, energy prices here were about three times what they are now, which is crazy if you think that there's a war, right? So energy was really, a couple of wars, energy was really, really expensive. So I had just bought a gaming PC. I had taken out a loan, taken out credit for it. I had one of the first like hex core CPUs you could have. I had an AMD XFX 6950, decent graphics card, some serious RAM, and a serious motherboard. And I go up to my dad and I say, "Hey, Dad, I want to mine this magic internet money called Bitcoin." And he says, "Okay, why are you asking me?" And I'm like, "Because basically to mine it, it's gonna require my PC to be running at 24/7 for an extended period of time." And he's like, "How much is that gonna cost me?" When I look at my PSU back then, it's like 1,000 watts. So I'm like, okay, about the same as AC running 24/7. He just laughs at me and says, "Shut up and go and play a game or whatever." and I did. And the block reward back then was 50 Bitcoin. And so that would have easily been 50 Bitcoin a day. Easily. Because the mining pool was so small, like nobody was doing it. It was, and I downloaded everything, set everything up. It was just like, press enter and you go. But I couldn't get myself to do it because I knew that I would have incurred my dad a bill of like 10, 15 grand or whatever it was back then, you know, because it was nuts. And although that being said, I've made my peace with it, because even if I was successful in mining it, I would have probably spent it on some Honda Civic when Bitcoin was $1,000, you know. It's $1,005 or $2,000, you know. It's look, very, very few people. Oh, I don't know any good people who kept Bitcoin for that long. The best people gave it away in the beginning. That's what people did, right? Yes. It was like you go out to a conference, it's, "Hi Marat, hi Sharon, it's nice to meet you. Have you heard of this thing called Bitcoin here? Open your phone. I'll send you some BTC in your wallet." And the best guys did that. Like one of the startups I advise, the founder, one of the founders basically, so it's a startup called ProofMe, and they focus specifically on digital identity, which is just because the identity of the founder had been stolen online, and then he got calls from the police. He's like, "Are you doing this? Are you doing that?" And no, et cetera, et cetera. So this guy basically sold his last 50 Bitcoin to fund the business. Wow. Right? But 50 Bitcoin, if you look at it in total, with like everything this guy had was nothing, because the majority of it was given away a long time ago. He gave away over like almost a million Doge. Just because that's what you did with Doge. That was the whole point. And if you ask me, that's still what you do with Doge, because Doge has zero inherent value. Same with Sheeb, same with anything that imitates that those coins. But let's say the industry has taken a weird turn. I'm yet to decide if it's for the better good. But it's definitely interesting times.
So I want to explore that. Actually, you said the industry has taken a weird turn, and you said there's a difference between the pre and the post 2017. So tell us what was the post 2017 people in the industry like, and how has the industry changed?
So before, okay, let me preface this with the fact that saying that I'm religiously agnostic, okay, and for the longest time was an atheist. Bitcoin is the closest thing I have found to a religion that makes perfect sense in my head. Okay, don't get me wrong, I respect all religions, but I'm saying this to point out that Bitcoin is more closely related to a religion than any other kind of idea in this world, or any other crypto. Ethereum is different, right? Ethereum has a god, as it were, and his name is Vitalik, and he walks among us. Bitcoin is somewhat different, right? And the reason why it gained so much traction in the beginning is it was just faith. It was just a bunch of cryptographers not even professional cryptographers. I'm still not even a professional cryptographist. I just had an affinity for encryption and for cybersecurity back then, and I still do. It's close to my heart. So some of the concepts maybe are a little easier for me to understand than for the average person, because I have an unfair advantage, of course. But everybody who was in this pre-2017 has somewhat of a similar background, or at least let's say the vast majority. Okay, let's call it the vast majority. Obviously, there are people that don't have this background, but definitely share this interest. Okay, so that's what's interesting. Pre-2017, people were in Bitcoin because it was the religion that would save the world. It's a new religion of money. That's what it was, right? So most people don't know that a dollar isn't tied to gold. What? What do you mean? Their mind blows to smithereens. For people like us, we've had this conversation over and over and over again. But you know how it is when you're very, very close to something. Sometimes you're guilty of drinking your own Kool-Aid, and you forget you can't see the forest because the trees are in the way. You know? It's very with Bitcoin pre-2017, it was nerds talking about it in a basement, the same way we talked about absolutely everything else, you know, like World of Warcraft, and for example, massive amount of World of Warcraft players who are original Bitcoin fans. Why? Because Bitcoin was one of the sort of virtual methods you could use to buy WoW gold, for example, right? Which is a currency in back then one of the world's biggest games. But you know, pre-2017 they were anarchists, and there were, because you know, Bitcoin is anarchy in some way. Let's face it. It's a juxtaposition, or not, it's a challenge to the status quo and the monetary system, right? And once people learn sort of that the gold standard is no longer a thing, and then they understand very importantly the Byzantinian emperor's problem, if they understand that properly, which if you're if you're somewhat of a nerd, it's a bit easier, right? Then you instantly see, and you saw what happened in 2008. Most important,
yes, I was going
to say
that.
What happened in 2008?
Yeah,
right. So you saw. So what did we see, Murad? We saw a couple of banks going under, a couple of banks, but we saw the majority of the banks being bailed out. We saw all the people lose their money up to 100K because the bank covers you for capital controls up to 100K. Everything else you lose, and everybody who actually caused the problems, who were on the inside, fine.
They were fine. Yeah.
Fine. That's when you realize something is wrong with the world, and maybe what you see, on the media isn't exactly what happens in reality. Mm. You know,
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, it was really a wake-up call. It was really, I would say, a bunch of people who really wanted to challenge the status quo of, being the slave of, the overprinting of a certain currency, namely the dollar, and stuff like that. Very interesting. On that note, I wanted to, for our audience, can you break down a little bit who owns Bitcoin, how it is, how does it work? You know, we have also a lot of people who want to really understand, is it owned by a bunch of people? You know, demystify a little bit the Bitcoin in a certain way.
Okay, who
tell
is
tell us
the...
about your religion.
Wow, I love it. Love the shot. would the audience be someone who's highly technical or someone who knows nothing at all about
It's very diverse, so we have people who are
keep
technical.
It simple,
and
keep it simple.
Keep it simple.
Okay, so who owns Bitcoin? Supposedly nobody, and I hope it remains this way. Now, the more technical answer is, imagine you are a bunch of friends and you're pooling in for a cab ride, right? And the more you pay, the farther the cab ride goes. You're all pooling in different amounts, but whoever pays the most has most impact on what the destination of the cab is. But in reality, it's not a cab. It's a bus with quite a few people on it, and most of those parties are paying more or less the same amount. That's the simple way to understand it. If you're not in tech, if you don't want to get into the specifics, why I think more than how it works, because if I may, Sharon, because this is what I say about what I mean when I say people can't see the forest. We can't see the forest because the trees are in the way, right? Nobody cares how it works. When people sell AI, when you buy Google Home, for example, they don't say in the store it uses machine learning, deep learning, and neural nets, and this. And no, you can play songs with your voice. You can create timers with your voice, and you can remind yourself about specific events. That's what it does. Now, what blockchain does is much harder to explain because it affects so many different industries. But I think why is it important is an easier question to answer. So let's put it simply. Let's say you are an expat and you're moving to Dubai for the first time and you're trying to buy a property. Now, Dubai, fortunately, is one of those countries that has a very, very low crime rate. So this isn't really much of a problem, but it's also an exception in the world because crime is only increasing. Okay, so let's say you buy a property from in that place, and you meet a real estate agent, and you agree to purchase a specific property. They make an agreement with the seller. You stick down some kind of deposit and you sign this contract. And the next day you give this person a call, you've paid the deposit in cash, the funds are gone, the person's left, There's no proof anything has been done, and everything goes to shit. So it doesn't sound like much of a problem. It doesn't sound like it because it doesn't happen so often in a specific country like Dubai. Around the world, it happens a lot. And the reason why there are many reasons why people don't talk about these problems, right? And most of it is embarrassment. Because so I deal with, I've had the fortune of trying to help a lot of people who have been scammed out of crypto scams. And these range from average people in the street, you know, to like a 60-year-old investing his family's funds, to a 30-year-old who's tech savvy and clicked on the wrong link, you know. So I've seen a lot of scams. I've seen them up close. And you always find there's always a question of embarrassment, right? So people don't, it takes a while for people to really tell you what happened. It takes a bit of confidence and a bit of trust because people...
We'll be right back after the break.
We believe that the financial system is broken and that our banks and insurance companies don't have our best interests at heart. We've built Techaturn to help us get together as a community to save, earn, and access credit. Join us today and discover how you can grow your savings while helping others.
People, you know, I mean, myself personally, I was scammed recently, about a year and a half ago. I think there was an NFT Porsche drop. I followed the real thing at night. I woke up in the morning, half asleep, made an Ethereum transfer with one eye open. I didn't even know what the hell was going on for $100. And I sent it to the wrong to the wrong address because it came from some stupid phishing email, right? It took me about 3 weeks to say, oh, okay, I'm a cybersecurity guy. And I just got scammed, you know? These things in the news, but they are real problems, right? Like, they're, for example, quite famously, there was a notary here in Malta who, a while ago who ran away and gambled off people's home deposits, right? Wow. of sort of 20, 30 people, right? So, wow. So the point is we don't need blockchain unless there is trust. But the more digital the world becomes, the less trust there is.
Interesting.
So this is very funny, and some people say ironic, because you're talking about blockchain being a solution to scams in the real world, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, when people think about blockchain and crypto, they're thinking about scams, and they're thinking that crypto is the thing that is scammy, or the blockchain is the thing that is scammy. How do you reconcile this?
That's very, very simple. So technology isn't good or bad. And technology is agnostic in itself. In the same way guns aren't good or bad, it's how you use them, right? So let's talk about tech in general has a trajectory, an evolution trajectory, which is the same across the board. Okay, every time there's some kind of new technical discovery, the first person to use it are the bad guys. Always, always, always. Because they have the most incentive to be able to use it, right? They have the most pressure in existing systems, so they look for different solutions. It's why, for example, the Mexican cartel traffic cocaine in submarines, right? They use submarines. Do you use submarines? I don't use submarines. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, but drug smugglers are using it because there's the use case calls for it. And it's the same with the internet, right? In the 1990s, the internet was used for almost nothing but pornography and Viagra. My apologies for the mention, but that's the reality. Let's say it how it is, right? Now we're in a state of the internet where you can order food from somebody you've never met, have it cooked by somebody you've never met and delivered by somebody you've never seen and touched, and pay for it with money you've never touched. Right? That's a far, far. Would you have thought this was a possibility 15, 17 years ago when all there was there wasn't even Google, there was MSN.
Yeah.
you know? So tech isn't like, websites can be used for to provide services, and they can be used as can be. So tech is agnostic. That's the first thing I would say.
Yeah.
The second thing I would say is it's 10 times easier to scam in the blockchain world, because very few people know something about blockchain, and lots of people pretend like they do and they get away with it. A really simple example, Logan Paul's NFT project, Gary Vee's NFT project. These are two of the biggest YouTube influencers in the world. Multimillionaires have sat down with presidents, shaking hands, or at least, I don't know, maybe I'm remembering some kind of funny video. But the point is, these are sort of respected heroes of society, right? And yet they had a scam NFT project and the world forgot. Why? Yeah. You know, because they can. Because they can drown it in confetti. Because they have the power, right? The nice thing about the blockchain is it never goes away. So anyone who's ever used it for any real illicit activity, it's just a matter of time.
To be caught, basically.
Exactly. It's literally just a matter of time. So I've had friends who've given me a call and said, hey, listen, I have a law firm who's basically a partner. Give me a call and say, hey, listen, we have a client caught in Amsterdam airport because of a Bitcoin transaction he made 8 years ago. Like, it's a public ledger, man. Like, eventually, something is going to come. You did something wrong. Can't help you, buddy. Bye. Like, this is just the situation, you know? So, but I think it's an evolutionary path, basically. This is the short answer to your question, Sharon. And I think if you have a bottle of water, two bottles of water, water A and water B, and water A has 100 million molecules, both waters have 100 million molecules water, right? H2O, and you in water A, you add just 3 molecules of cyanide, right? The first bottle of water will absolutely kill you, because it only takes 3 to poison a massive, massive amount, right? But in order for us to understand what cyanide is, what it looks like, what it smells like, even though it's technically overness, but anyway, we need to go through these cycles. We need to go through these cycles of people attempting to abuse the system, and the fact that Bitcoin has yet to crumble, if you ask me, is nothing more than a sign of its success. It's everything else which is really being bastardized, with the exception of wrapped BTC, which I think shouldn't really exist. But,
yeah. Right. Very interesting. Very interesting.
Yes. So back to the idea of, look, you talked about Bitcoin is the new religion of money, right? And you also said that a lot of those who subscribe to this early religion or subscribe to this religion early were anarchists, because it is a challenge to the status quo. Now, how is it a challenge to the status quo?
Okay, well, money is controlled. The issuing of money is controlled. The volume, the supply, it's all controlled. The monetary system is controlled, but it's not controlled fairly. The world is not fair. It was never designed to be fair. And most people, or rather the people in prosperity in such a situation, are happy to keep it that way. And in fact, I would argue the vast majority of the world's problems exist because we as a species are unfair. And I don't know, have this... It's not really based on anything else besides feeling, to be honest, right? But when you've spoken about something, like I'm used to having conversations with nerds, and those conversations remain in the shadows for many, many years, right? But when, you know, you're talking about something for a decade, and then, you know, you're mom, for example, comes and gives you a call and says, what's an NFT? You start to go, or what's Bitcoin? you start to go, okay, this isn't like everything. Like, people are actually talking about it now. And now we're in a situation where you know, there's conferences all around the world. We're having this conversation. The fact we're having this conversation, right, to me gives me all the faith I need to know that this industry is going to get into the right place eventually. Because when I was just looking at it, it was just like, just about $100, you know. This is why I'm so sort of upset with the way people handle it today, you know. Like, people, everyone is cared about the Bitcoin price.
Yeah.
Right? Which, don't get me wrong, I have all the respect in the world to anyone that is a successful trader. I am the world's worst trader. I've only ever lost money on trading. Okay, so in some ways, I'm a little jealous, absolutely. But let's face it, trading doesn't really create any value in the world. It just allows people to take calculated bets. It's also one of the many reasons why we are in the position we are today, and why 2008 also happened, right? Because we allowed traders to rule the world, and it's still very much the case now. I remember, for example, as soon as the oil price went negative during the Great Flu, let's just call it that for sake of algorithm. You know, the oil price announcement on CNN was it like 1602 1602 05, there was a massive trade in the oil market. It's like, you know, insider trading is just the way the world works. It's the like, people like Warren Buffett are many times smarter than me, I'm sure, but also many more times more informed.
Definitely.
Right?
Is an insider job, actually, you know. So I just want to make a small, you know, for our audience and the people, when we use the word religion loosely, we are apologetically Muslim. So it's not to offend anybody who's listening as well. Again, the early adopter of the Bitcoin, yes, they are like very bullish. That's why we call them maximalists. Somehow I'm having a lot of fun usually talking to them about this. And jumping into that, actually, what's happening, Jean-Michel, there's a big, I give you a small update. A lot of Muslims, actually, they were like, you know, as you mentioned, the blockchain is pure, Bitcoin is pure, you know, has never been hacked, if you can confirm that as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the science is like, you know, a car is a car is a car. And, you know, technology in itself is really, you cannot say haram, I'm driving a haram Tesla. You know, Tesla is is a car. So in a sense. So a bit of, you know, fast forward, I would say, we see a lot of Muslims jumping now, and you know, and yeah, part of this early believing in the blockchain. I see a lot of, you know, Muhammad Ali, Aftab, who have been very early in the game of building the ecosystem and been true believer of this technology. But somehow the masses, the Muslim population, they were like, this is a currency, or is a science of you know, drug dealing. Our scholars are saying it's not okay to use it. But then, in the past few years, there have been more people opening up to the reality of saying this sets you really free. Because as Muslim, quote unquote, when we look at the dollar is interest-based, you know? And since Muslims don't use interest, whatever it is, I cannot collect the interest when I put the money in my bank, and I cannot lend my money for interest. So we are the most affected population in the world when it comes to the riba system, I would say the interest-based financial system. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have Islamic finance coming in and jumping in. And what I see is like this huge potential amount of population globally, which is 20%, if they adopt to that technology, you have the earliest adopters and you have the people just catching up on trying to find a solution to the interest base. And that's where we're coming in a little bit with Takadao and Takashio. So is it, I mean, do you see the main trend taking place with other people besides, and what do you think about, you know, I don't know if you know, Sefadil Amour has been writing the Bitcoin Standard, and I think you will be a good host to his show and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm happy to share his book and stuff like that. So, yeah. So you see, it's a long type of introduction to the Muslim world, to the crypto blockchain. But what do you see the overall after that? And do you think that could be something that add up to the ecosystem?
I mean, first of all, and to sort of echo your comments, Murad. No disrespect to anyone's religion, right? By comparing Bitcoin to faith, essentially.
Yeah, no,
right?
Of course, yeah.
And in the same way that scholars think that Bitcoin is used for, and crypto in general is used for sort of malicious purposes, I think there are many people that think that religion is used for insidious purposes, right? And the when you really peel back at the layers, you realize there's nothing wrong with religion, right? Religion, if people use religion in the right way, it brings peace, it brings spirituality, it brings many, many benefits to their lives. The problem is not religion, the problem is people. And that use the guise of religion for whatever crimes or atrocities they wish to commit. And in very much the same way, Bitcoin is very much the same. It doesn't care. Bitcoin is agnostic, right? Yeah. You can do with it what you like, which is part of the beauty of it. But you know, but there are always going to be people who will abuse things in every society. And with the example I mentioned earlier of the water, the bad apples stand out more because people talk more about their bad experiences than they do about their good ones, just because it creates more controversy. This might put me in trouble with some people, but I am. The idea of interest is kind of broken. Yeah. Let's face it.
Yeah.
Like the idea that, now I'm not saying that Sharia finance is the solution in any way, right? So I'm gonna shoot both ways here, right? Mm-hmm. So the need for loans is real, but the cost of them is insane. It's insane, and the reason why, as far as I understand, the reason why, and just please feel free to correct me because I'm speaking from a place of ignorance here, but
yeah, no problem.
The reason why the interest is, let's say, not accepted in the Muslim faith is because it's an unethical way to make money. Long story short, right?
Yeah, it's not accepted in all religion. Let's put this thing in Christianity, it's not allowed, and it's not allowed in Judaism as well.
Really?
It's all forbidden. Yes.
I learned something yes. New today.
It's not new to Islam. It's forbidden to all religion. Even the Jewish, they never loan themselves with interest, even though they own many banks themselves. But between them, they will never loan with interest. They will do Kafd al-Hassan, like we are doing ourselves. A loan for a charity loan, they call it.
Yeah, I see. Of course, there's always a way. But
the modern Jewish and Christian, they have now adopt because they were bombarded. But if you go back 100 years, 200 years, the Christian, they will never lend you money with interest.
Wow, so interest is only 200 years old. That's so sad. We were so close to being a very peaceful civilization, I think. But I think the one of the main reasons why Bitcoin was created is to fairly distribute value. More than anything else, to fairly distribute value and hold the right people accountable under the right situations. I am not a finance guy, like I said. So trying to give you a prediction on sort of how the ever-changing Muslim financial mentality would affect the situation over the year would be a complete shot in the dark, and I'm just guessing. So I'll refrain from answering that question directly. But I do think that there are religious drivers which can be directly reflected on a blockchain to achieve better outcomes than the ones we have now. Okay, so what do I mean? So the reasons why banks exist in the traditional world, or let's say the reasons why banks charge so much for credit, let's just say that, is because, again, same example, if we have 1,000 people and you give out 1,000 loans, what are the chances that three of them are going to default on the loan? 100%. Mm-hmm. Right? If you have 1,000 people, three of them are definitely going to a default. Let's assume we're taking a sample case from the West, because obviously if you default in the UAE, even just one payment, you go straight to prison,
straight to jail.
so people just get up and leave the country instead. Yeah. But sort of more West, they would just default. And
they're working on their bankruptcy law, by the way. I mean, so you should, you know, it will take some time, but they're working
fair
on it.
Fair. My point is that that cost of fraud is shared amongst the total customer pool.
Yeah.
Because the bank needs to absorb those costs.
Those costs, yeah.
So I think that we with the example I gave to you earlier, and I'll come back to this and build this, like I'll come back to this, but with the example I gave you earlier of sort of ordering Uber Eats, right? You can go through this amazing process of eating food without, you know, ever speaking to anyone, ever, et cetera, et cetera. That, I think, is the culmination of Web 2. Okay? But Web 2 is cannibalizing itself.
Mm-hmm.
We're now in an age where you receive an email from someone, you can never truly trust it. You receive a Facebook message from someone, even Sharon, you're not even sure if it's Sharon's profile, right? Or if it's just somebody making some fake copy profile. So we're in an age now where there's so much fake news, there's so much distrust.
Mm-hmm.
Digital distrust that the internet is cannibalizing itself. So the next iteration is an identity-based internet. Whether that identity-based internet will respect the privacy laws or the privacy rights that Bitcoin intended to create in the beginning, and I say this knowing that usually security and privacy are two opposing forces, right? The more security you have, the less privacy you have.
The less privacy, definitely.
Now we are in an age where it's the dawn of zero knowledge proofs. And that, from digital identity perspective, destroys that argument, okay? Mm. They can now increase together. People just are just realizing that this is a possibility. Now, whether we go down the route of, you know, everyone has a self-sovereign identity on their phones, they own their own data, they have they have rights over that data, they can monetize that data, or we end up in a private blockchain, hybrid blockchain sort of environment where the government is holding that data, you're just accessing it, all the services are then connected. I don't know what the future will bring. All I know is the farther east you go, historically, the more likely the latter is to be a reality. That's number one. Number two is Europe has just issued a law that every country will have to have a digital wallet by 2028, I believe which, let's say, okay, yes, we have GDPR, but you know, it's not exactly.
It's not exactly what we want the crypto world to be in. I don't want them to just press a button and I have no more money in my account suddenly just because I tweeted something wrong.
Exactly.
It's going to get worse, actually.
And that is exactly what will happen. There will be two streams of the sort of evolution of the blockchain and crypto world. Number one, the Ripple stream. And Ripple at the moment is just an interbank settlement tool. That's all it is. But that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning of the ecosystem. It doesn't take much. If you've been in the space for a little while, it doesn't take much to see how it can evolve from there and become over encompassing, right? Yep. Then on the other end, you have the Binances of this world. I personally think Binance is one of the biggest scams in existence, and I can't believe it's not yet been destroyed. Mm-hmm. But my point is that both of those examples are two opposite ends of the same spectrum, right? And
you elaborate on for the audience why Binance, the difference between, you know, centralized, decentralized?
Okay, so it's not about centralized, it's not about decentralized. What everyone knows about centralization versus decentralization is a farce. It's just what news reporters write in the headlines to keep people busy and keep people talking. Oh, this thing is centralized, this thing is decentralized. Like, no, centralization isn't binary, and decentralization aren't binary. There's varying levels of decentralization and centralization. And if you understand the basics of the scalability trilemma, that you will understand exactly why that's the case, right? But without going into too much detail.
Yeah.
Binance is nobody makes $1 billion of profit in less than a year and a half of operations. That's all I'm going to say. $1 billion in profit. In less than a year and a half of operations, nobody, my friend. I don't care who you are. I don't care. I don't care like where you fell from. You're doing something fishy. That's all I can say. It wouldn't be the first time. It wouldn't be the first time. So we've been, you, I'm sure you know as well as I do that in this industry, very few things are often as they seem. It's something you realize with time.
Yeah.
You know, definitely. And you realize that there's many, many ulterior motives it becomes more prevalent as time goes on. But what does not change is people, and the nature of people doesn't change. Thankfully, evolution takes a little longer for us than Nvidia does, at least for now. Right. What it means is that our incentives, our psychological and sociological drivers are more or less the same as they were a couple of hundred years ago. It's just the social constructs which change around, but our nature remains the same. And it's those constructs which affect the end results. At the end of the day, whether we allow something like Binance to prevail or whether we, you know, say, hey, guys, listen, take your money off this exchange. Something bad is going to happen. Mm. You know, it's saying that publicly. I've been saying this now for a bit more than 3 years. If I said this 3 years ago, you would have probably laughed at me and said, "How are you talking against Binance? You know, they're amazing. They're the leaders of the space." Like, because that's what the news makes you want to believe. Yeah. In the same way, the news made me want to believe that you know, the Americans were really helping people in Iraq when they weren't. Right? Yeah. It's why the collateral murder video, etc., etc., etc. So. The blockchain space needs to have its own age of reckoning, I think, to not sound too much like a paladin. I guess it's a bit of a nerd joke, but
It's interesting to see that evolution. Tell me, you saw that. I mean, Sharon, you have something to. So you saw this evolution with Malta. Malta was in the forefront into the blockchain, crypto, and everything. Then we saw the movement going to Singapore now, Dubai. So how do you see the really like the core, you know, the hardcore, the OGs of this preservation of kind of freedom of owning our network and to build real solution, real dApp, real project? I know there's a lot of scam, but there's a lot of people really trying to move and work with the regulator if they have to try to understand that is a benefit for the country. And what I think myself, what I feel is the benefit will come from the South nation more than the North nation. So what do you see the movement of that? We see El Salvador even accepted Bitcoin, that it seems to be like a success story. Even, you know, they've been able to pay back their loan from the IMF. Very little is, of course, mention about them and the stats. So if you can, you know, tell me how this can evolve, you know, as well, and the movement from Malta to, you know, all these things.
So Malta was very early in adopting it, right? So I remember back then I was working at a cybersecurity company. I was head of APAC, and like I mentioned earlier, selling cybersecurity licenses to every large government and enterprise across Asia Pacific, from the sort of Korean Air Force to the Indian Navy to the Chinese, literally the Great Firewall of China, and everyone in between. And then Malta announces it's going to do this blockchain island thing. So I sold my apartment, quit my job, and opened this cybersecurity company. And we originally had 360 applicants, and 5 years later we have 5 issued licenses, or 6 I think it is now. And why? Because you can get a license in Estonia for €20,000, and a license here costs about €3 million. Which is good and bad. But back then, I was, you know, obviously quite angry because I had just made a crazy investment and it wasn't going great. But the reality is the bar needs to be high. So if the bar is low, you will have, it's just a perfect scamming machine, right? It's why Estonia withdrew 50% of the licenses it issued after the first year, right? Because, like we said, if something can be easily abused, and then people will. People always will. Man always will, right? So 5 years later, we don't have much of a blockchain island left in reality, although I say this with Sigma and AI, the AI and Blockchain Conference being next week. There is not really much of a scene left here. A lot of it has gone to sort of neighboring countries, but I still think that there is a lot of we're still doing it wrong, basically, Morad. We're still really doing it wrong. Like, centralized exchanges should never exist. DEXs, decentralized exchanges, should never exist either. They both of them do things in the wrong way for their own reasons. And we created the right way, but the world wasn't ready. I've made peace with that. But I'm doing my best to have let's say, faith in that humanity will, I don't know, come together and people from different parts of the world will come together to solve a problem that is bigger than themselves, and only then will people really see the true value, right? Mm-hmm. Like AI had its ChatGPT moment, you know. Robotics is going to have its ChatGPT moment very, very soon. Once the first Neuralink test is completed successfully, you see someone who's been in a wheelchair for 15 years start to walk again. The world will change the way it sees things. Blockchain needs to do the same thing. And it needs to do it in a way that isn't about money, but is about value. For example, charity. Just enable a charity case, enable a charity use case that actually changes the world and people actually see value in, or enable a way for people to lend money or borrow money without paying eye-watering interest, and watch the success and watch the ripple effects that has over years and years and years. You know, that's mainly the problem with the blockchain industry, is that most of the benefits aren't instant and they don't require a single party. They require multiple parties, and it will happen over time. But if that like El Salvador, for example, perfect example, right? There is so much more to be done, but I think first a few more people need to get out of Web3 and go back into AI or something else, and that will create the opportunity.
Yeah.
So this was a fascinating conversation. It's kind of the flip side of what we're usually used to, because people are usually not so nuanced and they don't usually go into sort of the pitfalls as well as, you know, what's good. Obviously, we all agree on what's good, but we don't always see what's bad. And I think we definitely need to sort out what's bad in order to get to what's good. So this was actually very, very thought-provoking. As a wrap-up, what sort of the last message would you like to deliver to the audience before we call it a day?
Yeah, what you do exactly as well, I know you're in the suburb, so you help people in that space. So describe, you know, what you do and how we can reach out definitely and everything.
So I did used to help some people with the sort of with crypto scams and stuff like that, but I've taken a bit of a step back from it. So now I spend most of my time, I consult a couple of startups, two fintechs and two blockchain startups, both based in digital identity. One is a startup called ProofMe that allows someone to grab their phone and grab their passport, slap them together, read the chip information and create a digital identity which they own on their phone and can digitally sign documents and self-authenticate. And the other one is a company called Trust Elevate, which is a tool which allows companies to safely onboard children's data online, which I think is one of the biggest problems of the current internet, right? And this goes back to, if you want to talk about what people can do, this I would say is a very good start. So I don't know a single parent out there that doesn't have a problem with Roblox if they have a kid between the ages of 3 and 7, right? The way it was explained to me nowadays, and I am a gamer, I will always be a gamer. There's a racing seat in the back. I have two swords on the wall. Gaming is what I do for fun, okay? But parents are telling me nowadays that, and I don't have kids, so I want to preface that, but parents are telling me nowadays that there's two kinds of chats that they have to have with them, you know, when they're kids. Yeah. There's the birds and the bees talk, yeah, and there's the Roblox talk. And okay, it's if you think about it for a second, right? Like, you would never let your 5-year-old kid with somebody my age at a playground.
Definitely.
We spend time playing together, but you have no problem if I'm speaking to this kid all day long on Roblox, right?
Yeah.
And that is very scary. If you're a parent, that's a really scary thing, right? Because people are some people are evil, you know, and they prey on the most vulnerable people in this world, and those are always children, you know. And we can't kids shouldn't be a kid's responsibility to understand if they're speaking to a pedophile online. It should be the responsibility of the service provider, and they're doing nothing about it. And parents are concerned everywhere, not only about abuse from third parties and bad actors, you know, but just their kids' relationship with this game, you know, like how is the game affecting their character? How much time do they spend on it? What are they actually watching? Is my kid on YouTube? What are they doing there? What content is being served? It's a minefield. It's not the same internet I had when I was a kid growing up. It was different, you know? So that, I think if what can people do nowadays? Fight to protect the next generation. Everything else will sort itself out.
It's amazing. And this product, mashallah, is available to you know, you're building a security safety for young people in those platforms. How can we have more information on that type of things? I would love to promote it even more, you know.
I appreciate that. So we do have a working demo in place. We have a tool built off of Unreal Engine, and anybody who wants a demo can reach out to me at jeanmichel@trustelevate.com. The name of the company is Trust Elevate. It's founded by a lovely woman who's an expert in the area, much more of an expert than I am in the specific area, named Dr. Rachel O'Connell.
Thank you so much. Very, very good. Thank you so much for your time. It was great having you, Sharon.
Thank you so much. It was a fascinating conversation, and thank you for coming on the show.
Taka Talks, exposing financial systems one story at a time.